Morning, everyone. My name is Nick, and I'm glad to be here this morning and glad to see you all. You look well. Hope you're doing well. So I want to share a little bit about myself, start by doing that, and then sort of launch into thinking about an idea together. And so the bit about myself. I became a very seriously religious person around the age of 21, and I started to believe very deeply certain things about God and about the Bible and about the world, and felt very sure of what I was learning. And then, like most of us, time passed, and I started to doubt some of those things that I was believing, and became very skeptical about what I had learned about God and the world and the Bible, like many of us. And I think skepticism often can be rather regenerative for us. So, you begin to doubt certain things, but then you come back with a stronger belief and a stronger faith. But for me, the skepticism has kind of gone all the way down and has never really felt like it's been quenched or like I've ever been able to return to a solid faith. And for me, it's really led more to cynicism, cynicism about religion, cynicism about kind of all of life. And that's really where I'm at right now. And so I've been trying to think about how does one move forward in a real, faithful way from the position that I'm in. And I've been trying to think about faith lately, not so much as faith as belief, which will always, to me, be vulnerable to skepticism, and thinking more about the idea of faith as imagination. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today, is the idea of imaginative faith. And so I want to say kind of what I think that means with the use of some scriptures and some guys named Walter. I will present kind of the concept of imaginative faith, what I mean by that, and then try to think about what does it mean to have imaginative faith in God. So I want to start by going to Luke 17 and reading a little bit from there, verses 5 and 6. And so that reads, "The apostles said to the Lord, 'Increase our faith.' And the Lord said, 'If you had faith like a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you.'" So if you're anything like me, you've kind of traditionally understood this scripture to mean something like the following. If you aren't doing tangibly great things, like moving mountains, then that must mean that you have zero faith. You have no faith at all. Whereas I hope that it means, and I want us to think about it meaning today, something more like barely believing or barely hanging on is an incredibly powerful thing. And I think the apostles here have this sort of weak faith. They say to Jesus, "Increase our faith." And on these occasions, Jesus doesn't say, "Okay, here's a recipe for stronger faith." He talks about the virtues and the power of having very little faith, of barely believing. So what does a weak faith mean? I think faith is weak in the same sense that knowledge is powerful. Knowledge is powerful because it offers certainty, it offers clarity, it offers a straightforward path ahead. And I don't think faith offers any of that to us. I think that faith is about possibility, and it finds its power in creating new possibilities. And so I think that in this scripture about the mustard seed, that we can sort of derive the first component of imaginative faith, which is accepting the possibility of something that's impossible. And that's really, I think, what imagination is. It's to, for a moment, accept and exercise the possibility of something that was before impossible. And here, the tiniest grain of faith allows for the possibility of these incredible things. So faith can be sort of the pebble that keeps ajar the door to the divine, the door to the impossible. A very humble task, but a very powerful task at the same time. But I think there's another fold to imaginative faith, which I would call imaginative fidelity, which is to practice the possibility of that impossibility, to practice it. And so a story, I think, helps illustrate this fold of imaginative faith. So if you think of the woman in the Bible who was bleeding for 12 years, and she spent all her money on all the professionals and found no healing. And so she thought to herself, maybe this poor homeless rabbi, this teacher, could do something. She probably said to herself, I know it's absurd to think that, but I'm going to try anyway. And so she walks in the heat. She pushes through the crowds, and she touches the hem of his garment, and she's healed. And he says to her, your faith has made you well. And so that's kind of what I mean by practicing the possibility. You walk in the heat, you push through the crowds, despite the fact that the possibility that you've accepted is probably absurd in some way. That's kind of the idea, the concept of imaginative faith, is to accept the possibility of something impossible and then to live as if it's the case, to act on that possibility. And so now I want to consider what it might mean to have imaginative faith in God. And to do so, we'll turn to an unlikely place, but I think it's a place that explores powerfully this dynamic, and will probably get us a little bogged down and confused, but we might come up with a little grain of insight. So if you have a Bible, go to Luke 19, and I'm going to read a long parable to gain something very small from it. So bear with me for a second. And this is the parable of the talents, and it reads like this. In verse 19:12, he says, he said, therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him, saying, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good servant. Because you have been faithful in very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And he said to him, and you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here is your mina, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow. He said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank at my coming, that I might have collected it with interest? And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one who has 10. And they said to him, Lord, he has 10. I tell you that everyone who has more will be given, and from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. But as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me. So I don't want to reflect on the broader meaning of this parable or on the violence involved in the parable. What I want to kind of focus in on is just what he says to the last servant, what the master says to the last servant, which is, if you remember, he says, I will judge you according to your own words. I will be exactly to you who you imagine me as. I will be to you who you imagine me as. And I think this expresses a powerful dynamic about God, potentially, that who we imagine him as matters for who he is with us and among us. And there's a quote that I want to share from Walter Brueggemann, who's a Christian theologian, Bible scholar, and he says, God brought to speech is a supple reality in which we exercise great freedom in who God gets to be among us. I'm going to say that again. God brought to speech is a supple reality in which we exercise great freedom and who God gets to be among us. So who we imagine God as, who we speak of God as, matters for who God gets to be in this world, in our midst. So perhaps how we imagine God matters. And I'm defining imaginative faith as accepting the possibility of the impossible. So I think we have to ask the question, what is the most impossible thing about God? Where does skepticism strike most acutely? And for me, you know, this may be different for you. For me, it's benevolence. It's that God might be benevolent. And I'll tell you why. If you look at the world we live in, the poverty, the violence, the disease, the fact that 30 shots were fired last week on one night in a neighborhood in this city, the abused kids, the grown adults that I've met in this city that never learned how to read, the systems of neglect and greed and racism. For me, it's impossible to believe that there's a benevolent God at the heart of existence. All rational thought tells me that there is not. And trust me, I've heard all the sort of philosophical explanations for how God and evil can both be that are running through everybody's head right now, but I found none of them convincing. So to have imaginative faith in God for me means accepting the possibility of the greatest impossibility, that there is a benevolent God amongst us. So to me, that God is good is an impossible proposition. But imaginative faith prompts me to accept it as a possibility despite this, and then to practice it, to live as if it is the case. And I think we have to ask, you know, what is the power in this sort of thinking? What is the power in this sort of weak, imaginative faith posture? And I think that to accept the possibility of a good God shapes how we see the world and who we get to be in the world, but I think it does more than that. And so I'm going to read a quote from another Walter Wink, who's also a theologian, and he says, "In terrible times, God may appear to be impotent. Perhaps God is. God may be unable to intervene directly, but nevertheless showers the world with potential coincidences that require only a human response to become miracles. When the miracle happens, we feel that God has intervened in a special way. But God does not intervene only occasionally. God is the constant possibility of transformation pressing on every occasion, even those that are lost for the lack of human response." So if Wink is right, it is not only that how we imagine God shapes how we see the world, but it also might shape God's actual presence in the world. God needs us for God to be able to enter our midst. And reality, that which really comes into existence among us, is a co-creative act between God and us. God, the divine, the impossible, and us, the faithful, the pebble in the door, as the opening through which God might come. Thank you.
Many of you don't know this, but I'm actually a traveling preacher. It's true. It's true. In fact, I preach more often than Charlie does, as you can see by his apparent absence today. It's just that our subject matter is slightly different. I'm actually a safety rabbi. Safety rabbi. So I travel across the country every week, and I meet with different organizations to improve the safety of their employees. And it's different than the traditional way of beating people over the head with rules and regulations. We work on improving communication. We involve employees at every level of the organization. And we use recognition to reinforce those positive behaviors that we're looking to improve within the organization. It's not about rules. So in order to improve employee safety, we really have to look at the culture that exists within these organizations if we want to make it better. So what is culture? What's culture? You have no culture. Yes. The way people live and do things. Very good. Yes. Unwritten rules. Yeah. It's what we do without thinking about it. Shared behaviors. Traditions. Very good. Anybody else? All of those things get transmitted from one generation to the next. So how does that look within the church? How does culture look in the church? Beliefs. We have shared beliefs. What else? Theology. Different ways of doing church. What we do in here probably looks different from other churches across Peoria, from other churches across the U.S., obviously across the world. We have different ways of doing church. And that is a part of our culture. Recently, I was down in Texas visiting my cousin. He's the one on the left, if you couldn't figure that out. Yeah, the hair. It's the hair. He's a firefighter, as you can see there. And he had just recently changed from one department in a major city in Texas to another one. And after we exchanged our pleasantries and sat down and talked with his wife, and they've got a little girl, and they've got another little girl on the way, he was saying, you know what? The number of fires has dropped significantly over the past couple of decades, but the number of firefighter fatalities has remained flat, which means that the rate is actually increasing. So now, putting on my safety rabbi hat, I'm like, what's causing that? What do you think? He said, well, I've noticed that the new department I'm with is much more safety conscious. The old department was charge in with axes swinging, rescue at all costs. And the new department is like, we got to assess the situation before we just go charging in. It's more about safety. And he said, well, you know what? Something else I noticed in my old department, everybody wore yellow helmets. Everybody. So the guys that had been there, the old veterans, the crusty old guys, their helmets were no longer yellow. They had been weathered and charred over the years. But the rookies really stood out. Nobody wants to stand out. So what do you think the rookies would do to try to blend in? They would charge right in. The guys with the least experience would put themselves in extra risk so that they would blend in. They wanted to be like the old guys. In his new department, however, everybody wore black helmets. Much more safety conscious. Everybody looked the same. The new guys and the old guys. And when you move departments, you start out at the bottom of the ladder again. It's a firefighter joke. Ladder. Thank you. So when he was in the situation, when he was with the first department, he didn't realize that yellow helmets were a problem. That was a tradition that had been bestowed upon him. Does that make sense? He couldn't see it. He was so close to it. It was rooted in tradition. And what we find when we go into these organizations is sometimes we've done things a certain way forever. Doesn't mean it's the right thing. So in a traditional safety culture, we go into these organizations, the people at the very top of the pyramid are the ones that set what's important for the organization. And everybody else below them follows along because people generally do what the boss wants or they don't work there anymore, right? So they say what's important, and they say what is most important to the employees, which is not always the correct thing. And so what we do when we go into these organizations is we turn that on its head. The best part of my job is going into what we call a rapid improvement workshop. So we get about a dozen employees from across the organization. Most of them are the frontline workers, right? The ones that are out there swinging the hammers. And we say, now, if we could do things the way you wanted them to be done, ideally, what would they look like? So when we get these employees together, they come together on a Tuesday, and they don't know what to expect. They've never met each other before. They come from different trades, different levels of the socioeconomic ladder. Sometimes they're from different states, and they don't know what they're about to get into. So we take those people, and we put them in a boardroom for a week, which none of them have ever experienced before. And at the end of the week, they have to present out to the executives what they've created. So we have these people that are normally out in the sun all day, sitting in a boardroom, looking at a PowerPoint and Excel, creating these accountability matrices and metrics and training programs and recognition systems. And at the end of the week, we bring in all the executives. And these people, who have never before had a voice, present to them what they've created. To the astonishment of the leadership, they can't believe what they have done. And I had a president of a company say, you know what, this is what happens when you unleash the potential in people that have never before had a platform. And it changes the culture. Not just for safety, but quality improves, engagement improves, people are happier to come to work, and ultimately it leads to life. It leads to life because people aren't taking risks anymore. could save their life or the life of one of their coworkers. So what does that have to do with us? So how do we cultivate a culture where our relationship with God, with each other, with our community flourishes? How can we be intentional here about identifying those unintentional yellow helmets that are putting us at risk? Well, I think it's, it probably has something to do with the way Jesus taught us to live. You're going to see some of my friends up there. Some of those that previously didn't have a voice that have now made impacts in major ways across this country. So what did Jesus do to change culture? Well, similarly, he took 12. He took 12 unassuming, nondescript fellows, those frontline workers, if you will, and he helped them accomplish something much more greater than themselves. They're clumsy, they failed sometimes, but their actions inspire things far greater than themselves. When I was sitting here this morning, I was looking at all these pallets and how no two pallets up here are the same. And they're not pristine. They've got cracks. Some of them have fractures. But I think this really does a great job in representing what our church looks like. So to change a culture, it sometimes requires you to step out the comfort of what you've always done. To step away from what's familiar, to associate with people you've maybe never had a conversation with. You might actually have to do something. Maybe it's hosting a Suppers for Six. You've got the sign-up sheet going around, right? Maybe you can invite some of the people in this room you've never met. Maybe even some of your neighbors, God forbid. It might look like serving our homeless friends at a breakfast club. Maybe it's going to Honduras to build houses for the destitute. Maybe it's attending a community event like the recent one we had here in Peoria, No Islam, No Peace. That's K-N-O-W, by the way. Sometimes it's simpler than that. In August of 2014, my wife Gina was diagnosed with a grade 2 oligodendroglioma in the right frontal cortex of her brain, right next to the motor strip that controlled the left side of her body. We had a one-year-old son at the time. We were living in Arkansas, far away from our friends and our family. But that distance didn't matter because you, church, are the ones that got us through. It was things like our small group that drove over 8 hours just to pray and have dinner with us the night before the operation. It was things like near strangers that paid for our airline and accommodations in San Francisco to have the tumor removed. And it was our friends in our church community in Little Rock that brought us meals during her recovery. The neighbors that babysat our son through the countless appointments that we had following her surgery. Nobody alone could have carried us through that very difficult time with so much uncertainty. But it was those individual, everyday sacrifices that built a synergy that got us through. It brought us life. It was you. It was all of you that were Jesus to us. And that made all the difference. Friends, we fail to experience the great potential of our church when we don't reach out to others when they need it. We fail to bring life when we retreat into our fear or our stubbornness and don't seek to understand those around us, those that look different from us. If you view yourself as a seat warmer here, as a bystander, as an average, everyday Joe fisherman, let me tell you, you are more than that. You are uniquely created with gifts and talents and sets of experiences that can make all of us better. So to change our culture, to improve our culture, I ask you to love not as you need to be loved, but as others need to be loved. And to do that, you're probably going to have to get to know them. Maybe, just maybe, you'll find the potential in those people or yourselves you didn't know existed. Maybe you'll find something in common, and maybe, just maybe, you'll spark something that will bring his kingdom into our culture here and now when we desperately need it. Thank you.